Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Today we'd like to send a special thank you to the following restaurants for supporting No Goat Left Behind: The Spotted Pig, Issa, and Breslin. Show your support at these restaurants by ordering one of the menu items featuring goat. Goat is the most eaten protein in the entire world, yet in the US we import most of our goat. Our dairy farms are forced to kill some male goats at birth because there's no market for them. Help make a change. Support No Goat Left Behind.
Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Helen Holliman, back for another week of radio, hanging out in Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today I'm joined by two men that are helping fuel one of my serious vices of chocolate. I've got Tim McCullum and Joe Salvatore of Modicos Chocolates. Is that the proper pronunciation?
That's as good as it gets. Yes.
Oh, nope. Awesome. Okay. Did I pronounce your last names properly?
That's great.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome. That's a first. So, for listeners out there who haven't tried this chocolate, it's very unusual. There's so many things going on with it. But first and foremost, can you kind of lay the groundwork for what it is that you're creating?
We'll try. So we're creating chocolate. We're also creating a lot of social change through the chocolate in Madagascar, which is this big island off the coast of Africa. It's one of the only fine chocolate bars that's made in all of Africa. And through that process, kind of helps change the status quo for cocoa farmers and producers all up and down the value chain in Africa. So it's got this incredible social story behind it, but I think what makes it equally as compelling is that it's a really good tasting chocolate as well.
It's the most delicious I've ever tried. So you were in the Peace Corps, right? Just kind of explain what were you doing in the Peace Corps and how did you get to create a chocolate company in Madagascar?
Yeah, that's a kind of a roundabout sort of path from Peace Corps to chocolate. But yeah, Joe and I, and then our other business partner, Brett Beach, we were all Peace Corps volunteers in Madagascar. And my experience in the Peace Corps was that of an English teacher. So I taught English to basically elementary and high school age students in Madagascar. And that was back in 1999 to 2001. And I had zero interest or awareness of cocoa or chocolate or even the specialty food world. But what we did do in the Peace Corps kind of developed this very deep appreciation for the country itself of Madagascar. And it's for those people who don't know what the Peace Corps is or who haven't done it or know someone who has, it's a very grassroots type of experience. So you're sent to this foreign country, very poor country, to live on your own and help develop the country at a very grassroots level in a small village somewhere usually. So that's what we did. But going through that process of learning the language and forgetting everything that you knew about the world, and basically starting over in a different country, in a different setting, it's a really special experience, and it really is a deep experience you don't forget. And what we wanted to do through this company was take that experience and use it to make chocolate and to do something that no one else has done before.
So let's explain, either of you, what kinds of chocolate you have. And you also have vanilla extract, correct?
Yeah, we also do vanilla from Madagascar. So, Joe, you want to walk us through the
what we have,
the current lineup?
Yeah.
Sure. So we have like a classic dark chocolate range that goes from 63% to 80%. Maybe about 5 bars in that category.
So what does that mean for listeners who are like loving the Twix bars?
Sure, yeah. So a Twix bar probably has about, 10% cocoa, okay. if that.
Okay.
it's negligible.
Got it.
But so this is dark chocolate, anywhere from like about 60% and above cocoa percentage. That means you have a lot more cocoa content, whether it's cocoa butter or cocoa solids. And so you get a lot more rich flavor out of that, less sugar. The more cocoa percentage you have, the less sugar you have in the bar. So it goes all the way up to 80% for ours. And then we also have specialty bars. We have a milk chocolate bar that's about 44%. So it's really high in cocoa for a milk chocolate bar. And then we have pink pepper and citrus infused dark chocolate. We have a sea salt and cocoa nib, which is one of our best sellers. And then we have 2 new ones coming in. We have an exotic pepper, and then we have 2 new ones coming up.
I just tasted the cocoa nib one, and it's delicious. It's amazing. And we were talking before we actually went on air about how fruity your chocolate bars are.
That's something from Madagascar in general. The cocoa from Madagascar is known to be very fruity.
It's amazing. And I had the privilege of speaking with Brett on the phone kind of about the company, and he walked me through like the growing conditions of Madagascar and some of the, I think I read somewhere like 80% of the plant species on Madagascar is found nowhere else in the world. Is that right?
Yeah.
So how does that play into vanilla and the growing of these cocoa beans and all of that?
Yeah, I think it plays into almost everything that you find in the country. An island, Madagascar, separated from the African continent about 65 million years ago, and then it just went off on its own evolutionary course. And everything you see there, from the trees to the birds and butterflies and lemurs, which a lot of people associate with the country, is totally different. So it's a huge hotspot environmentally. Some of the world's biggest environmental agencies, like Wildlife Conservation Society, WWF, they're all very, very active there. How that affects agriculture is very unique. Even in the coffee world, they've discovered something like 4 or 5 new species of coffee that are just growing wild in the mountains of Madagascar. They'd never been documented species in coffee before. And what you have in the food world is a term called terroir, which is a French term, but it means basically wherever something is grown, whether it's grapes for wine or potatoes for French fries, there's something locally about that environment, the combination of the wind and the soil and the genetic makeup of that crop, that you really can't put your finger on. It's just the combination of everything makes the flavor so much different or unique. That is especially true in Madagascar, where you have unique cocoa and vanilla. And as the world knows more about the culinary traits of cocoa, for example, Madagascar is developing a very, very good reputation for having the best cocoa in the world.
So how does that, that being said, it sounds like a paradise. And how do you deal with that in terms of preserving it and maintaining it without people trying to kind of capitalize on it in a way that takes advantage of it?
I'll point out too that it does sound like a paradise. In a lot of ways it is a paradise, but it's also one of the 10th poorest countries in the world.
I just mean from like a growing perspective.
And this comes up a lot too from that idea. It's the fact it's kind of helped us a lot in Madagascar. The fact is that we've lived there, we've known the people and known the poverty and what causes that, and also the special, like the unique nature that's there. So it allows us to kind of navigate things I think a lot of other people aren't able to navigate to get to those crops and to get to that cocoa and other things. So
you guys are working, you started working with the Izaka cooperative, right?
Yeah, Izaka, yeah.
And you've since started to work with other cooperatives as well. What is the... I guess day-to-day life of like someone who works in the co-op, and how does Modicas work with that?
Tim just crossed a river to get to our newest cooperative, so maybe he can.
Yeah, I was there a couple of weeks ago. Day-to-day life of a farmer in Madagascar, I don't want to say it's impossible to put it into American terms, but it very well could be. Basically, they're villages that haven't had any contact with the outside world, or very little, at least in the last 50 years since the country was colonized by the French. So the further out into the hills you go, the further away from any traces of what we would call civilization you find. Most of the villages that we work with, they don't have any signs of anything that's been invented in the last 500 years. And it's almost how I would imagine medieval Europe to be in some ways, in that you have farmers living in thatch huts. They oftentimes, their tools are literally made out of stone. The only modern inventions, quote, inventions you'll see are like some farmers might wear denim shorts, like cut off jeans. Some roofs might be made out of tin. Other than that, everything's natural. So you don't have a lot of a track record of working with people who are familiar with what your standard and quality needs to be. But basically, you know, a farmer would wake up when the roosters wake up, which I don't know, it's like 4:30 in the morning or something.
Unfortunately, yeah.
And there's usually a pack of wild dogs running around, and they make a lot of noise in the middle of the night. But, you know, you wake up and you just start working. Like, you sweep the floor, you put a little bundle of wood together for a fire to cook rice. You eat rice 3 times a day, huge plates of white rice, and that's all you eat. And they just start cooking the rice. It takes like 40 minutes. And while the rice is cooking, they sweep the floor and they have their morning meal. Then they'll go out to the fields and they'll start harvesting their cocoa. And each farmer, because we work with really small groups of farmers, they don't make all of their income from cocoa, usually about 60%. So on the same small parcel of land, the same farmer will have cocoa, mangoes, papaya, rice, coffee, which they just grow for their own subsistence, and the cocoa is really what they make most of the money off of.
It's funny, here that would be considered like a very like classy way to do farming, you know, biodynamic and all that stuff. There, it's like just a way of life.
Yeah.
It's your natural, very, very organic, very, very natural way to grow
yeah.
crops.
No, it's great, and it's just funny in the context of the yeah. U.S. because you're like, it's local, sustainable. It's like, no, it's just how it's been done for centuries.
The other funny thing about that is, we get asked all the time, is this organic chocolate?
Oh,
and
it's fair. It's a fair question.
It's a legitimate question, and we're glad people are concerned about it. But the reality is, a farmer in Madagascar cannot conceptualize what the word organic means. And if they could, there is not an herbicide or pesticide within 200 miles of where they live.
Yeah, right. We couldn't make it not organic if we wanted to.
And if there were, they could never afford it anyway.
Right.
So we don't laugh at the question because people, you know, it's an honest question, but that's just the type of environment that we're working in.
How do you answer that? You're like, yes and no, but yes.
You're like, do you have 20 minutes?
Yeah. Right,
I can actually explain it. So they harvest the cocoa and then it's sent to where?
Well, it's sent on a journey.
An ox cart.
The cocoa is harvested from, exactly, it's harvested from a tree, and then it's broken open on the spot. And inside of a cocoa pod, which is about the size of a football, you have cocoa beans. They're encased in a white film to begin with. That's removed. You go through a fermentation and drying cycle that usually lasts about 10 to 14 days, at which point they're put into these huge gunny sacks, the way that you'd see, you know, pictures of coffee in gunny sacks. And they're thrown on the back of an ox cart. Ox cart's the primary transportation in rural Madagascar. And sometimes, you know, they'll travel up to 50 kilometers in this ox cart along a dirt road. You'll have to cross rivers and really navigate your way across this road, which coincidentally turns into a river during the rainy season, which is a whole nother host of issues. But and then eventually it makes its way to a factory that's about 300 miles away in the country of Madagascar, where it's processed into this really wonderful chocolate that we have.
And we've got so much more to talk about, like your master chocolate maker. Is that the nut chocolatier?
Yeah, what do you call
that? That's the worst title I've ever used. But we're going to take a quick break on that note. But stay tuned, because we have more from the men behind Modicast Chocolates. You're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. If you're just tuning in, you are listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm still your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm joined today by two of the wizards behind Modicast Chocolate, Tim McCullum and Joe Salvatore. And before the break, we were talking about a bunch of stuff, but most recently, a day in the life of a cocoa farmer. And we got to the part where they drop it off and it's dried and fermented in the sacks. But you guys have a really amazing chocolatier.
We're still, the verdict's still out on what the name
title,
is.
Title, yeah.
He's the guy who makes chocolate.
Yeah. He's the Willy Wonka of Madagascar. I don't know, that's wrong. So who is he? And how is he different than... He's very different, I think, than any other chocolate maker in the world. He's got a huge advantage, which is home court advantage, first and foremost. But anyway.
So, his name is Shaheen. He's a great guy. One of the things that makes him different... There are a lot of things that make him different. One is he doesn't have formal schooling in chocolate or culinary arts or anything like that. He wanted to start making chocolate one day and had some ideas. I think it's an advantage because, and it comes out when you taste the product, but he's not really boxed in by any conventional way of making chocolate. The other huge advantage, that home court advantage as you put it, is we're so close to the cocoa and the source that we have better access to it and better sourcing. This also gets back to that earlier conversation we had about Madagascar, which is just like that amazing island and what that has to offer. But there are all of these spices that exist in Madagascar, and yeah, they exist in other countries, but the quality and caliber of the ones in Madagascar are just always better. And that includes cinnamon and cloves and nutmeg and all these other spices that are grown locally that we've started to get a little more adventurous with the chocolate and include those in some of our chocolate creations.
The pink pepper corn, for example, the bar we have that has pink pepper and kombava fruit in it. It's really hard to get the pink pepper from there off the island. It can spoil quickly after you pick it. So you have to really work with it on the island. So that gives them an advantage. And something cool about working with Shaheen also is that because maybe he hasn't gotten that formal training, he's much more open to collaborative efforts. And Tim and Brett have worked with him extensively on building recipes and ideas for new creations. And I think that working with maybe someone who had a little more refinement, I guess. I don't know if that's the right word, but they might not be as open to that. It's made the relationship work very well.
Well, also just for listeners too, like most chocolate, most high quality chocolate out on the market, you know, it sits around for months before it's created into an actual chocolate product. So I mean, you guys are making it very quickly in terms of, you know, harvest to store or whatever.
Yeah, it's the transportation time between the two is shortened quite a bit.
Yeah, so I mean, and you can taste it because, as we were saying before, the terroir, the delicious dish moment of my show. But it's true. I mean, this chocolate is very fruity, and you know, I've tried the higher percentages you go, the fruitier it gets, so to speak, right? I mean, it's crazy. Delicious. Yeah,
you'll notice even from the 63% bar to the 80% bar that they taste completely different. And it's the same cocoa, it's the same everything. It's just that different percentage can really change from a floral note to a fruity note.
So, all right, you know, people in the U.S., we love to name things like pet names, like sustainable, organic, like we were talking about before. We love the phrase fair trade, but I don't necessarily think everyone understands what that is to begin with. And you guys are doing, you're reaching above and beyond the fair trade mark. So can you explain what fair trade is and then how you guys are different than fair trade?
Yeah, I'll take that one.
It's like the hardest question. Yeah,
it is because... rightfully so, fair trade has its own, you know, brand and consumer awareness, which is generally positive. They do good things on the balance. I think where we're coming from is a totally different place, different experience, different point of arrival where we want to be with our business. But in a nutshell, fair trade focuses on agriculture, specifically agriculture in developing countries. So you're looking at South America, like fair trade bananas, fair trade coffee, cocoa. And it makes sure that farmers are paid a transparent and a fair price, which is great. What we do is take that about five steps further. And if you like the idea of fair trade as a tool for poverty alleviation or for doing your part as a consumer to help increase the lives of people at the beginning of the value chain, it's great. If you're looking to actually fundamentally change the status quo of why a country's poor, then it doesn't hit the broadside of a barn. And I mean that with respect, but it's just the way it is. We also tell people, you know, Africa is not poor because it does not produce enough agriculture. They're the world's leading producer of cocoa, coffee, bananas, rubber, a lot of raw materials. Africa's poor because that's all they do. There is zero secondary industry at all in the country, or the continent, rather. So you look in the case of cocoa, 70% of the world's cocoa comes from Africa, but the statistical equivalent of 0% of the world's chocolate is actually made there. And until Africa makes chocolate instead of cocoa, nothing, no matter how big fair trade is, nothing's going to change on the ground there.
It's such a crazy, weird concept to think about it in that way. Well, yeah.
Fair trade plays from a marketing point of view, it's a great role. I mean, you can go into a store and you can see right away which ones are going to make a difference, which ones aren't. And that's so important because there's so many different messages out there. There's so many different products trying to say they're doing this or that for the environment, for the earth, for people and all that. So fair trade's great for that, you know, letting people, consumers know. It's tough, though, because it only, like Tim had said, it hits a very small part of the problem. It actually doesn't hit the full problem.
So 5 years from now, you're going to keep making this delicious chocolate. What are your relationships to these cooperatives? And, you know, who are these people? Obviously, they're friends of yours. And, you know, what do you hope to have a projected future of impact within that community? Is there anything you're trying to do at the moment to, I don't know, facilitate positive change beyond what you're already doing, I guess?
Yeah, we're quite active with them. I think friend is a good way to put it. We're colleagues and partners in this together. Also, when we visit them, you know, we stay in their homes and they feed us and we bring them gifts, and it's a very congenial relationship. I think where I'd love to see this thing go is, you know, we first started working with a cooperative of 25 farmers. Now we work with four. and we're starting to expand into vanilla, and they all are farmed by cooperatives as well. And we're starting to get a little more of an idea of just how interesting and diverse our own company can become. But we see it as having a very active role in the cultivation of cocoa, vanilla, peppercorns, coffee, all from Madagascar. And at the rate we're growing and trying to keep up with the demand for the product in the U.S., very quickly we're going to be working with hundreds of cooperatives. And I think that's the direction this is going. And as long as we stick to why we started this business in the first place, I think we're going to be one of those companies that did it right. Like, they grew at a good pace. They never forgot who they were. And we stick to our mission, which is to change the status quo in Africa and do it brick by brick, but do it.
Do it right.
Yeah. Well, and how many times a year are you going to Madagascar?
I usually spend about a month there out of the year. And then my colleague Brett spends about a month there out of the year. Joe's going to be taking a trip next year, hopefully. We've got a good team in place on the ground there. So I think between our company, we go or try to go about once a quarter, once every 6 months. But,
yeah, and that's important too, is we always have like a presence in Madagascar. It's, you know, it's building relationships with the businesses there, but we also have people there that keep track of what's going on and work with us and all that. So
the Kombava fruit chocolate bar, which I can't
which
stop thinking about, because I think it's more just like Kombava fruit sounds so delicious, the name. Yeah. But what is Kombava fruit and what's in the chocolate bar and where can I get it?
You got that when you want me to.
Go ahead, Joe. Hey. You look like you're chomping at the bit.
Because I'm also a huge fan of Kombava fruit. It's very common. So there's a variety that's in Madagascar that's hard to find elsewhere. But it's also used, a similar version is used in Southeast Asian cooking. So you'll notice it in a lot of Thai food and a lot of like Southeast Asian, Malaysian style cuisine. Like, you'll notice it's a very tart citrus, but it enhances, like lime does, like it enhances every other flavor around it. And that's what it does with the cocoa. So when you add it with cocoa, we add a little bit of pink pepper along with that. It really just enhances the flavor that's
the
around.
The fruitiness.
Can you imagine a key lime pie? Oh my God.
Oh my God, I know. Well, yeah, are you doing anything else besides eating it straight up? Like, do you like to use the chocolate for any home applications?
In weird ways, I use it in chili. I use both our chocolate and our vanilla.
Are you from Ohio? Or
no.
Interesting.
I've passed through. Maybe that's
okay.
Why.
Okay, Cincinnati chili. Interesting. Yeah.
It's great. I mean, it evens it out a lot. Vanilla is actually really good, too, with any type of tomato-based sauces. Or
really?
Yeah, it evens out the acidity.
Crazy.
And so you can keep the seeds and all that nutrients inside the sauce, but still have a very balanced flavor profile.
And it doesn't taste like...
It doesn't
taste
because yeah exactly. It doesn't if you put a cap full in there maybe
yeah
just
wow.
A tiny bit, it's gonna even it out.
You learn something new every day. So the website, if you don't mind spelling it out for everybody.
It's Madecase, is MadeCasse. Made case.
And it's called Made Case. It's real good.
But if you simply Google Madagascar chocolate,
it will pop
up.
Yeah,
good call. Can people buy it online? Where can they locate it?
Yep.
You can get it on our website. You can get it at a lot of stores around Brooklyn and New York City. And nationally, it's available at Whole Foods and a couple of other retailers.
It's delicious. I'm staring at it and I want the whole box. It's so good. But unfortunately, we are running out of time. But thank you so much to both of you for coming on the show, Joe Salvatore and Tim McCollum. And thanks to our listeners out there for tuning in to another episode of You Look Hungry. Thank you to Jack Inslee and Carlos Salguero and the rest of the crew at Heritage Radio Network. Tune in next week for another episode.
Let's go out to eat and get some meat. Turkey and jam, macaroni and ham. Say, do you like steak? I can surely make. If you hear me now, sing it loud for me, cry.
Thanks for for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. This is a public service announcement from Sea to Table and Slow Food NYC.
On October 11th, sustainable seafood distributor Sea to Table will join Slow Food New York City to host an event celebrating the bounty of local New York seafood. The event, Slow You, Sustainable Sashimi, will feature a tasting of four fish species from local Montauk waters. The event will take place on Tuesday, October 11th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Institute of Culinary Education, 50 West 23rd Street in Manhattan. Tickets are $25 for Slow Food members, $35 for non-members. Visit slowfoodnyc.org for more information about this event and how to get tickets.
As a part of National Food Day, St. John's Bread and Life, Brooklyn's innovative and life-saving food service program based in Bedford-Stuyvesant, is inviting Brooklyn chefs and purveyors to learn about how the organization is marrying the procurement of old-fashioned, locally grown organic produce with the latest technology to deliver healthy, cost-effective meals to those in need. St. John's Bread and Life, located at 795 Lexington Avenue, will hold an open house on Monday, October 24th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Visit www.foodday.org to sign up for the event. This is a public service announcement from American Meat Documentary.
American Meat, a new documentary that chronicles America's grassroots revolution in sustainable meat production, is going to screen at Movie House at Third Ward in Williamsburg on Sunday, October 9th, in partnership with Local Food at 7, and the film will be at 8. There will be a panel discussion afterwards with Stacy Murphy of BK Farmyards, filmmakers Graham Merriweather and Mimo Salazar, and other food producers and advocates. That's Sunday. At 7 p.m., show up for Local Food. At 8 p.m., the film screens. At 9:30 p.m., the panel discussion. The suggested donation is $10, and the address is 3rd Ward at 195 Morgan Avenue.